Hi, I'm Nigel Famas. In our SAFM documentary in these last 3 weeks of March, I'm profiling three extraordinary South Africans. Last week, the late Zain Ibrahim, community radio guru.
My black friends had to go around the back, couldn't knock on the front door. So that was the daddy I grew up with.
Next week, Joe Mennell, formidable documentary maker, worldwide adventurer, and community television director.
I'll have a group of Xhosa guys saying the trouble with the coloureds is they are amper bas.
There were a lot of so-called coloureds, you know, who felt superior because the government had made them feel superior.
This week, Sindiwe Magona, winner of more than one Lifetime Achievement Award, novelist, biographer, poet, language and gender activist, translator, and much more, including the odd honorary doctorate. All three were born in South Africa, spent many years abroad, and then returned to the country of their birth. Each has marched to his or her own drum. Although our extraordinary South African this week is Sindiwe, we'll hear a comment or two from Zain and Joe. Usual disclaimer, the opinions are not necessarily those of SAFM, etc. In 2018, Cape Town celebrated the 75th birthday of Sindiwe Magona at the rather cavernous Centre for the Book, where, speeches aside, Mandla Mbotwe had organised his students in a musical and spoken tribute, which included a praise singer. We'll also hear Sindiwe talking at the launch of her latest novel, Chasing the Tales of My Father's Cattle, at the book launch.
It's something that I have wanted to address for a long time. African women, women everywhere, and tradition, and how tradition has really betrayed us, totally betrayed us. Instead of protecting us, tradition has betrayed us. I'm not saying all tradition is wrong, but I'm saying we need to open our eyes and examine things. Tradition comes into place at a time because it is necessary. It's not God-given. What is the role of traditional leaders? If you're in the rural areas, you would know there is a law out there that has nothing to do with the Constitution. Am I lying?
It's not funny.
Ha-ha!
To begin at the beginning.
Gungululu, that's the village where I was born. Gungululu is in Tsolo, a little dorp, you know, between Mtata and Kumbu.
And you have very strong memories of your grandmother?
Both of my grandmothers, yes, because I lived with them until age 5.
Why was that?
Well, it's tradition almost that, you know, the first child or the first two children of a young couple will go and live with the grandparents while the young couple courts. Because, you see, my parents, like many people their age, didn't court before marriage. They got married and then got to know each other thereafter. And so they were, I think tradition allowed them the time, you know, when they were together to find each other and to establish themselves as a couple. And while my father worked away from home, of course, like many men in the village, you know, my mother was getting grafted into her new home, her new family. She lived with her in-laws. And so she was becoming part of that family. And sometimes it's better not to be stressed with, you know, by the presence of children while you're learning to become a daughter to another family.
The family soon moved to Sandy Blofley in Cape Town.
Blofley was a tin shack location. Very much like latter-day, you know, crossroads, except it wasn't so densely populated as crossroads. It was more widely spread in retreat. And that's where I grew up, among the hills and vales and dales of retreat.
Sindiwe's short story, Push Push, about a pyramid scheme in the 1950s, which she adapted for radio, is set in Blofley. The Bush radio production starred Tembi Mshali and Shimano Sebe.
Oh, money! The push-push money has come! It has come! Oh, thank you, Lord!
No, not yet, Tataka Nozimbo. But it will come. And soon, as surely as the sun rises in the east, it will come.
I loved words even as a child. I remember in Standard 4, the teacher had given us the daffodils to recite, to learn overnight, copy it down into our notebooks, learn one stanza, one for homework. And people couldn't recite these four or five lines. I recited the whole poem and I was quite happy. And actually, I was so doff in terms of the social skills. I expected the rest of the class to applaud me. I mean, because of the joy I felt. I thought this would just infect them too. They would just, you know, feel how excited I was. They were not excited. They were quite angry with me. It wasn't really showing off, but I suppose it was. Because to me, it was like, look, it can be done. It can be done. It's easy. And it's actually fun.
Yes, you roll your eyes now at your naive belief there. Do you think you've still retained some of that naive quality?
Unfortunately, I've grown much older than when I was in Standard 4. But something in me, the child in me, is still very much there. Really, I remember it about age 12, 13, you know, on the dunes of Musenberg Beach, looking at the aunties and the mamas there, and consciously telling myself, I am not going to become like that. Even in terms of form, I'm not going to allow myself to have lumps and bumps all over my body. I don't want to look like that when I'm old. I was horrified. And as I grew older, by age 16, I discovered that, especially women, lost the zest for living. They didn't play once they left school. They became mothers only, and they never played. I play, honey. I like playing. I don't see why you should relinquish all the things that you enjoyed in childhood. And I made a promise to myself that I wouldn't forget what fun it was to be a child. I wouldn't forget to play, to laugh. So,
she has certainly kept her promise. She laughs easily and is a dedicated walker and practicer of yoga. However, back then, the young Sindiwe was easily embarrassed, first of all, by her parents.
Resentful, embarrassed, and just felt I'd been dealt a raw deal by God. You know, my parents were not educated. They were, even then, there were kids in school with better educated parents. My parents didn't have any desires outside their family. You know, they didn't jostle for position in the school committee or whatever. They didn't, not that they didn't care, but they didn't care enough to be involved. And when you talked about positions, even in the location, to be headsman or to help the Bantu inspector who wasn't Bantu himself, my father's, you know, rejoined us, so-and-so likes position, let him have that. They were involved a little bit in the church he preached. He was a lay preacher. That was the highest office he ever held.
This was what, the 1950s?
The 1950s, yes. We came to Cape Town in 1948.
48, yes. Mm-hmm. Very significant year.
An early arrival for the Commonwealth Conference being held in London was the Union of South Africa's Prime Minister, Dr. Daniel Malan. This was the Premier's first visit to Britain since the Nationalist Party came into office.
Well, I would just say that...
The headmaster summoned a meeting and said, "Today is a very dark day in our history. A government has come to power who will undo and destroy the civilization that the Empire and the Republic had set up in this country. And from here on in... We are looking at dark times ahead." And this was 1948, and Malan had just become Prime Minister, and I remember the speech.
Joe Mennell, our final extraordinary South African, next week. Having attained her junior certificate, or Standard 8, or Grade 10, Sindiwe could now train to be a teacher.
People don't know what great breaks we got from apartheid. Only Africans could go and do teacher training after Standard 8 and be called teachers. We didn't have to suffer through matric.
But she had also experienced that teachers could be dishonest. Back to push.
Is it true, Manala? Is what they say true? The teachers ran away with the
teachers? cheaters, Mfazi. Don't ask me. I know as much as you do.
Dear, dear God.
They say a man tried to drown himself in the flame because of this.
Because of Push Push?
Because of the money he has lost, Mama Kazno Simbo.
Nowadays, we are quite skeptical about the behavior of many teachers mm-hmm. in many of the schools. But mm-hmm. in those days, of course, teachers were... They looked up to, they were trusted like the ministers and the
yes.
doctor, weren't
yes.
they?
Yes, they were held in very high esteem in the locations, as they were called then. We didn't have townships. Very high esteem. And it was a disillusionment for me as a pupil that my teacher was involved in that. And it was a teacher I loved very much, and he liked me. He used to call me daughter-in-law. I would marry his son when I grew up.
Sindwe is still involved with education. Theo Crano of Sparkle Kids at her 75th.
How she's transformed a school in her Hermanus area where the words were just not entertainment, or not just entertainment, but it became substance in a young child's life who's forced and faced with abuse and abandonment and the worst things that our country could throw at them.
I didn't teach for the first 3 months. I couldn't find a job. Then in April, somebody got married, and I got a post in Nyanga. Nyanga was then called Nyanga East, at Lingisa Higher Primary School. That was my first real job.
And great celebrations and family and...
Great excitement.
Yes. And then?
Then a month later, I found out I was pregnant. So 3 months later, my proud teaching career came to an end. Then pregnant teachers, unmarried women, were kicked out of school. These days, they get maternity leave. You couldn't teach because that was, you know, terrible for the morals of the girls.
All right, so you had to leave teaching.
I left teaching. By the time the baby was born, I was in domestic work. And 2 children later, I got married. When I found myself pregnant again, I got married this time.
Again, embarrassment played a role.
I was embarrassed into getting married. I didn't think it was the best thing to do, but it just seemed to be the only thing to do by then. And, you know, it didn't last very long because it wasn't right. We were both penniless.
And how did he feel about it?
He felt he was doing the right thing. When he did the right thing. But 2 years later, he didn't think it was the right thing, which is why he ran away. It was too much for him. He was only 25, I was 23, when we were expecting the third child. And then still worked in domestic work until I was pregnant with the third child. So I did 4 years. These kids came rather thick and fast, one on top of the other. So when I was expecting my last child, my third and last child, I left or was caused to leave domestic work.
Caused to leave?
Before he left, my very nice, I'm using that word, husband, told my madam that I was pregnant. And he, the concerned husband, since I delivered by cesarean section, didn't want me working. So end of June, woman gives me my 20 rand. And he says, you know, I'm sorry you are leaving. And my eyes pop and he said, well, your husband said he doesn't want you working anymore since you're pregnant and you have this difficult delivery. I'm only 4 months. The woman didn't want to hear. So you know the law. The law said I was a minor and my husband made all the decisions.
An early bitter lesson in patriarchy.
Husbandless, workless, 2.5 children because the other one is coming in a couple of months and bankrupt. Penniless.
Dear Sindiwe, you have lived more. You have lived deeper. You have felt with more sharpness. You have tasted bitterly. You have struggled harder. You have accomplished...
Anki Kroch at the 75th birthday celebration.
When my father left her, she never doubted that raising 3 children was another option other than that. And she didn't think that leaving the children was an option at all.
Sindiwe's daughter, Tokozile Saedwa.
I think her children inspired her, and also her parents. My grandparents were not educated, but put together, they didn't even have a high school diploma, but they were very supportive of her. And amongst many things, they taught her that the only way out was education. And they always said, even my mother passed that on us as women. I have a sister and a younger brother, but she said that our society does not cater to women the way it should. And there's only one thing a man or anybody cannot take away from you, and that was your certificate, your education. No matter what, you can always shake the dust off and keep on going.
I went back to domestic work and selling sheep heads and ginger beer and God knows what else. And when the baby was 6 months old, I got a teaching job. With that teaching job, the first salary that came, I enrolled at Damilin College for my matric. You know, in 2 years flat, I had matric. By that time, I was teaching at a secondary school, which later became Fezeka High School. It was Fezeka Secondary then. And from then, I got a job as a welfare worker.
Why did you go from teaching to the welfare?
Better pay. Better pay, better working conditions, more security. Working for the city council was not a bad idea at all. And things like that. And with my education, whatever little qualification I got, I swear, I saw a distinct improvement in my working life. And so that encouraged me to just go on. After matric, I did A-levels through the University of London, again by correspondence. And after that, I did a BA through UNISA. Well, you know, all this studying and all this, there were still basic things that we didn't have in the township. Not only in Guguledu, not only didn't we have electricity, not only didn't we have warm water, not only didn't we have toilet seats, but, you know, a hole in the ground for toilet. We had no baths, you know, or bathrooms. There was that toilet outside the house and that kind of thing. But because of the differentiation in salaries, even as a teacher, my salary was at the bottom of what I call a six-layer dung heap, where we had the white male salaries teacher at the top, followed by white female, then colored male, colored female, then African male, then African female. Then somebody's going to come and tell me I must fight for women's liberation. I didn't want to be liberated from the African men. I wasn't fighting for the African men's salary. I wanted the white men's salary. So race and gender were very linked in our oppression. And therefore, every step of the way, you had to think about what is better now for me to do. I worked for an office in town, SASET, the South African Education Trust. You know, I ran the office. You know, they awarded scholarships, bursaries, scholarships, loans, and things like that. And one of the exciting things was that wish I had kept copies now. I dealt with the correspondence from Robben Island.
Now armed with her degree, Sindiwe was offered an opportunity to further her education in the United States. She could choose between New York and San Francisco. She chose New York. You'll never guess why.
I looked at San Francisco, and much as I liked San Francisco, I was so scared of those earthquakes. I thought, no, let me go. And I didn't like New York because of the extremes of weather. But I thought, I'll stay with the winters, and the frightful winters and snow and everything. I don't trust those earthquakes. That's the only reason I went to New York and not San Francisco. I'm a bunk brook.
All right. So you escaped the horrible earthquakes of San Francisco, and you went to New York's extreme climate, and also, of course, it's, you know, the sort of most hectic city probably in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And you went there.
And thanks God I did. That's how I got the job at the UN.
All right. Tell us about the UN.
While I was studying there, I went, being a good Christian woman, I often went to the Riverside Church. And there I met someone called Julian DeVet from Weinberg. And Julian then told me about this job at the UN where they were looking for a Xhosa-speaking South African. And I applied. And many, many, many months later, I had already graduated. I got the job on a part-time basis when I was doing second year of my master's.
And what was the actual job?
The job was, you know, translating, adapting radio programs from English to Xhosa. There was something called the Anti-Apartheid Radio Program Unit at the United Nations.
And here it's time for us to say goodbye and invite you to join us again on the next edition of UN Africa. I'm Cindy Wemagona Gobodo, saying so long.
Living in New York, which Sindiwe did for 2 decades, proved challenging at first.
To start suddenly as a black South African who had never once in her life in South Africa looked at the real estate section of the Cape Times or the Cape Argus, because what did that have to do with me? Who couldn't even apply and get a council house? I didn't qualify. Never mind, we were not allowed to buy or to rent the other houses. And now I have to try and find housing for myself. I don't know how to start. That's how retarded the system had made us. I think we moved 3 or 4 times before we found the place where we called home for almost 20 years with my children. You know, to live a normal life after living under apartheid is quite a challenge. But there were reliefs too. There was the relief of not having to have your heart do, somersaults at the very sight of a policeman. That uniform didn't mean anything to me. It didn't have to, where's my pass? Did I bring it? Will he ask for it? Oh God. You know, that kind of thing. No. A policeman meant nothing. Nothing. What a relief. In fact, you could approach a policeman and ask for directions. You could approach a policeman. Wow.
I like it when the policeman asks me, Meneer, is everything okay? When a policeman not glare at me and want to shoot me.
Zain Ibrahim, speaking of his Netherlands experience.
I like that. I deserve that.
All that time in New York, Sindiwe was writing. And back in South Africa, she didn't stop.
You are very young still. Your blood will call out for a man, her mother-in-law said.
You may have heard Sindiwe reading her novel Chasing the Tales of My Father's Cattle on SAFM. This short excerpt addresses the pressures of tradition.
We think it best you stay with Mfi Usandile's family. In dismay and denial, she shook her head. She had no interest in ukungenwa, being entered by the brother of a deceased husband as a wife, tradition.
Her work ranges from Chasing the Tales to the autobiographical My Children's Children to the heartrending Mother to Mother, which has been adapted for stage, starring Tembi Mtshali, whom we heard in Push Push.
Mother to Mother is a novel. It's fiction. But it's fiction based, unfortunately, on a real life story. The murder of an American Fulbright student, Amy Elizabeth Beale, 1993. A day before she was supposed to go back home after a year here. And I didn't write that book immediately. I found out that one of the 4 young men implicated in that murder was the son of a childhood friend of mine, someone I played childhood, in that sense, someone I played with as a child, someone I knew, you know. And that troubled me greatly. But I didn't think I was writing a book until 2 years after that, June 96. I started because I didn't have the courage, the guts to approach Amy's mother. But I had a feeling of what this woman would have said to Amy's mother had she the opportunity, the vocabulary, and etc., etc.
And of course, the HIV/AIDS themed Beauty's Gift, recently revised.
Women get sucked into tradition, religion, marriage is sacred, and what is a woman without a man kind of thing. And if you sacrifice your life to these so-called ideals, you may end up very much dead.
Sindiwe Magona, a truly extraordinary South African. I haven't scratched the surface. I refer you to her writing. Check out the podcast of this 3-part series on the SAFM website. I'm Nigel Famas. My thanks to Bush Radio for the use of the Push Push excerpts, to Tokozili Sayedwa, Nancy Richards, and to you for listening. Next week, the irrepressible Joe Mennell.
I think political correctness is the worst because you sweep it under the carpet.